varsity football at his adored alma mater, Columbia University, in the late 1970s. He'd captained the team to its sole Ivy League title in 1961 as a tough-as-nails 165-pound linebacker. Half a century later, he chaired the university's board of trustees. But Coach became the coach. After trading the gridiron for another arena of head-on competition, namely the boardrooms and executive suites of Silicon Valley. He was a world-class listener, a Hall of Fame mentor, and the wisest man I've ever met. His ambitious, caring, accountable, transparent, profane humanity built the culture at Google and many dozens of other companies to what it is today. As Ken Auletta wrote in The New Yorker, quote, "In the world capital of engineering, where per capita income can seem inversely related to social skills, Campbell was the man who taught founders to look up from their computer screens. His obituary was not featured on the front of most newspapers or at the top of most technology news sites, but it should have been." I first met Bill in the late 80s when I was recruiting a CEO for one of my most famous failed ventures, the Go Corporation, a pen-based tablet computer company. Bill's joke was that we should have called it Go, Going, Gone. He came recommended by Deborah Radebaugh, the top executive recruiter in Silicon Valley. I'd already recruited Bill's old marketing boss at Apple, Floyd Kwame, to be our partner at Kleiner Perkins. The deal was sealed when I visited Bill's team at Claris, the Apple software subsidiary. I'm usually quick to judge whether I'm ready to get in trouble with an entrepreneur, though it may take me a while longer to persuade them to get into trouble with me. Claris had such great esprit de corps and such obvious esteem for Bill that I was sold on the spot. When Apple and John Sculley refused to spin off Claris in an IPO, as Bill believed they had been promised, he took the job at Go. Though Go's business model flopped, we had a fabulous time together. Before Bill arrived, Go's executive team would argue heatedly about strategy and then vote. The process created winners and losers and sometimes hard feelings. After Bill became CEO, all of that changed. He'd sit with individual executives and ask them about their families and tell a story or two in his colloquial way. And gradually he'd find out about how they felt about the issue at hand. He had a magical way to get people to agree in advance before they came into the room. There was no dictating, but there was no more voting. For Bill, it was always about the team, the company. He was devoid of private motives or agendas. The mission was paramount. Bill was a master leader who developed great leaders. Five of the vice presidents who reported directly to Bill at Go became CEO, or chief business officer, of their own ventures. And I backed every one of them, and every one of them turned a profit. One of the many lessons Bill taught us was the importance of a team's dignity, especially after a company fails. When Go sold out to AT&T, we made sure that those who were fired had great references and found good homes for their careers. So I brought Bill back with me to Kleiner Perkins as an executive in residence and installed him in the corner office next to mine and promised to find and buy another company for him to run. Around the same time, in 1994, Intuit founder Scott Cook decided that he wanted to hire a CEO. After I introduced Bill to Scott, it took just one walk around Bill's neighborhood in Palo Alto for the coach to get the job. He and Scott built a wonderful relationship and a spectacular company. Early in Bill's four-year tenure as CEO, he faced a crisis. Intuit's revenues were lagging. They were going to miss the quarter. We had a blue-sky, visionary board of directors who were pushing to invest more capital and power through the shortfall. When the board met in a hotel suite in Las Vegas, the coach wasn't buying it. "Cut the crap," he said. "We're going to cut back and lay some people off. We're going to get leaner because we've got to make the numbers. It's part of the discipline and the culture I want." Bill had strong feelings about delivering results, for the shareholders, but also for the team and the customers. But as we went around the room, more and more directors came out for spending and plowing through it all. I could see Bill getting more and more distraught. Then it came around to me and I said, "You know, I think we should go with the coach." I wasn't sure if he was right or wrong, but I thought it was rightfully his call. My position turned the tide. Later, Bill told me how much what I said had meant to him, and that he might have resigned had it gone the other way. From that point on, we had an unbreakable bond. We could disagree and say some pretty harsh things, but the next day one or the other would call to apologize. Both of us understood that our loyalty to the relationship, to the team, outweighed any business differences. Bill was still at Intuit when I recruited him for the board at Netscape, and soon he became my first call whenever I backed a new entrepreneur. It became our MO. Kleiner invests, Door sponsors, Door calls Campbell, Campbell coaches the team. We ran that game plan again and again. In 1997, Steve Jobs returned to Apple in the most amazing non-hostile takeover of a public company ever. Without putting up a penny, Steve asked for the resignations of all but one of Apple's directors, and then he called Bill Campbell to join his new board. The coach refused to be paid for this work. His view was that he was giving back to the Valley that has done so much for him. When a few companies prevailed upon him to accept stock, he funneled the proceeds into his philanthropic organization. In 2001, after helping persuade Google's founders to hire Eric Schmidt as CEO, I advised Eric that he needed Bill as his coach. Eric was a rightfully proud man who had already served as CEO and chairman at Novell, and he made it pretty clear that he was offended by my suggestion. "I know what I'm doing," he said. So it wasn't love at first sight for him and Bill. But in less than a year, Eric's self-review showed how much he'd come around. Quote, "Bill Campbell has been very helpful in coaching all of us. In hindsight, his role was needed from the beginning. I should have encouraged the structure sooner, ideally the moment I started at Google." Bill saw his Google mandate as open-ended. He coached Larry Page and Sergey Brin and Susan Wojcicki and Sheryl Sandberg and Jonathan Rosenberg. Indeed, he coached Google's whole executive team. Bill's style was one part Zen and one part Bud Light. He gave little direction. He'd ask but a few questions, though. He had a gift for the right ones, tailored to the individual. But mostly, Bill Campbell listened. He knew that most times in business there were several right answers, and the leader's job was to pick one. "Just make a decision," he'd say. Or, "Are you moving forward? Are you breaking ties? Let's keep rolling." Bill kept a close eye on OKRs at Google, with a particular interest in the less glamorous, committed OKRs, a favorite expression delivered with a characteristic dash of salt. "You've got to make the effing trains run on time." As Google CEO, Sundar Pichai recalls, quote, "He cared about operating excellence, day in, day out. It went back to Bill's deceptively modest-sounding motto, be better every day. There is nothing more challenging or more rewarding than that." The coach was the eminence grise at Google's Monday executive staff meetings, our unofficial chairman of the board, if you want to know the truth. At the same time, he served as lead outside director on Apple's board, and the seeming conflict drove Steve Jobs crazy, especially after Android emerged to challenge the iPhone. Steve harangued Bill forever to choose Apple and leave Google, but the coach refused, stating, "Steve, I'm not helping Google with their technology. I can't even spell HTML. I'm just helping them be a better business every day." When Steve persisted, the coach said, "Don't make me choose. You are not going to like the choice I'm going to make." And Steve backed down because the coach was his one true confidant. He kept Steve going, as Eric Schmidt told Forbes. Bill was Steve's mentor, his friend. He was the protector, the inspiration. Steve trusted him more than he trusted anybody else. Though the coach knew more about technology than he liked to let on, he wouldn't intrude on the domain of engineers or product developers. His superb insights were about leadership, what made business teams and people tick, and how to protect your people from your process. If he saw someone steamrolled or treated unfairly, he'd pick up the phone and call the founder or CEO and say, "This was a process error," and he'd fix it. Generally speaking, people are discouraged from bringing love into a business setting. But love was Bill's signature element. I can still picture everybody's face lighting up when he'd walk into a meeting at Intuit. Sometimes it was love by faux insult. If you came into work in an ugly sweater, he'd needle, quote, "Did you roll some guy in the restroom to get that thing?" But you always knew the coach cared. You always knew he had your back. You always knew he was there for the team. You don't find many leaders who can convey love and unblinking critical feedback at the same time. Bill Campbell was a tough coach, but he was always a player's coach. He got love. He got family. He was absolutely the happiest when out coaching his daughter Maggie and my daughter Mary in softball. He'd be on the field at 3:20 sharp, regardless of what big meeting might have been starting someplace else, and the coach was completely present. He wouldn't be distractedly checking his cell phone in the sixth inning. He sparkled in that setting. Bill never stopped coaching even after he got sick. When I took on the chairmanship of Kleiner Perkins a few weeks before he died, his advice was a big factor. With my two daughters off to college, the time was right. The coach knew I wouldn't be moving upstairs or slowing down. Rather, I'd be taking the job to accelerate what I love doing, finding and funding the best entrepreneurs and helping them build great teams as they scaled. And most important, to become a player coach for the next generation of leaders and partners at Kleiner Perkins, following Bill's example. In a podcast with my Kleiner partner, Randy Komisar, a few months before he died, the coach explained that he always wanted to be part of the solution. People are the most important thing that we do. We have to try to make them better. Bill is gone for his many hundreds of disciples, all the executives he coached over all those years. His work goes on. We're still trying to get better every day. I miss you, Coach. We all do. Resource 1. Google's OKR Playbook. No one has more collective experience in implementing OKRs than Google. As the company has scaled and scaled, it's periodically issued internal OKR guidelines and templates. The following excerpts are drawn mostly from internal sources and told with Google's permission. But I want to note, this is Google's approach to OKRs. Your approach may and should differ. At Google, we like to think big. We use a process called Objectives and Key Results, OKRs, to help us communicate, measure, and achieve lofty goals. Our actions determine Google's future. As we've seen repeatedly in Search, in Chrome, in Android, a team composed of a few percent of the company's workforce acting in concert towards an ambitious common goal can change an entire mature industry in less than 2 years. Thus, it's crucial that as Google employees and managers, we make conscious, careful, and informed choices about how we allocate our time and energy as individuals and as members of teams. OKRs are the manifestation of those careful choices in the means by which we coordinate the actions of individuals to achieve great collective goals. We use OKRs to plan what people are going to produce, to track their progress versus plan, and coordinate priorities and milestones between people and teams. We also use OKRs to help people stay focused on the most important goals and to help them avoid being distracted by urgent but less important goals. OKRs are big, not incremental, and we don't expect to hit all of them. If we do, we're not setting them aggressively enough. We grade them with a color scale to measure how we did. 0 to 0.3 is red. 0.4 to 0.6 is yellow. and 0.7 to 1.0 is green. So let's talk about writing effective OKRs. Poorly done and managed OKRs are a waste of time, an empty management gesture. Well-done OKRs are a motivational management tool that helps make it clear to teams what's important, what to optimize, and what trade-offs to make during their day-to-day work. Writing good OKRs isn't easy, but it's not impossible either. Pay attention to the following simple rules. Objectives express goals and intents, are aggressive yet realistic, must be tangible, objective, and unambiguous, and should be obvious to the rational observer whether an objective has been achieved. The successful achievement of an objective must provide clear value for Google. Objectives are the what's. Key results are the how's. They express measurable milestones, which, if achieved, will advance the objectives in a useful manner to their constituents. Key results must describe outcomes, not activities. If your KRs include words like consult, help, analyze, or participate, they're describing activities. Instead, describe the end-user impact of these activities, such as publish average and tail latency measures from 6 Colossus cells by March 7th, rather than assess Colossus latency. Key results must include evidence of completion, and this evidence must be available, credible, and easily discoverable. Examples of evidence include change lists, links to docs, notes, and published metrics reports. Let's talk about cross-team OKRs. Many important projects at Intel require contribution from different groups. OKRs are ideally suited to commit to this coordination. Cross-team OKRs should include all the groups who must materially participate in the OKR, and OKRs committing to each group's contribution should appear explicitly in each such group's OKRs. For example, if ADS development and ADS sustaining reliability engineering and network deployment must deliver to support a new ADS service, then all three teams should have OKRs describing their commitment to deliver their part of the project. Now, let's talk about committed versus aspirational OKRs. OKRs have two variants, and it's important to differentiate between them. Commitments are OKRs that we agree will be achieved, and we will be willing to adjust schedules and resources to ensure that they are delivered. The expected score for a committed OKR is 1.0. A score of less than 1 requires explanation for the miss, as it shows errors in planning and or execution. In contrast, aspirational OKRs express how we'd like the world to look, even though we have no clear idea of how to get there, and or the resources necessary to deliver the OKR. Aspirational OKRs have an expected average score of 0.7, with high variance. Here's 6 classic OKR writing mistakes and traps. Trap number 1, failing to differentiate between committed and aspirational OKRs. Marking a committed OKR as aspirational increases the chance of failure. Teams may not take it seriously and may not change their other priorities to focus on delivering the OKR. On the other hand, marking an aspirational OKR as committed creates defensiveness in teams who cannot find a way to deliver the OKR. That invites priority inversion, as committed OKRs are de-staffed to focus on the aspirational OKR. The moral of this trap is get it right. Trap number 2, business as usual OKRs. OKRs are often written principally based on what the team believes it can achieve, without changing anything they're currently doing, as opposed to what the team or its customers really want. Trap number 3, timid aspirational OKRs. Aspirational OKRs very often start from the current state and effectively ask, what could we do if we had extra staff and got a bit lucky? An alternative and better approach is to start with, what could my or my customer's world look like in several years, if we were freed from most constraints. By definition, you're not going to know how to achieve this state when the OKR is first formulated. That is why it is an aspirational OKR. But without understanding and articulating the desired end state, you guarantee that you're not going to be able to achieve it. The litmus test is, if you ask your customers what they really want, does your aspirational objective meet or exceed their request? Trap number four is sandbagging. A team's committed OKRs should credibly consume most, but not all, of their available resources. Their committed plus aspirational OKRs should credibly consume somewhat more than their available resources. Otherwise, they're effectively commits. Teams who can meet all of their OKRs without needing all of their team's headcount and capital are assumed to either be hoarding resources or not pushing their teams, or both. This is a cue for senior management to reassign headcount and other resources to groups who will make more effective use of them. Trap number five are low-value objectives, also known as who cares OKRs. OKRs must promise clear business value. Otherwise, there's no reason to expend resources doing them. Low-value objectives, LVOs, are those for which, even if the objective is completed with a 1.0, no one will notice or care. A classic and seductive LVO example is increase task CPU utilization by 3%. This objective by itself does not help users or Google directly. However, the presumably related goal, decrease the quantity of cores required to serve peak queries by 3%, with no change to quality and latency, and return the resulting excess cores to the free pool, has clear economic value. That's a superior objective. So here's a litmus test. Could the OKR get a 1.0 under reasonable circumstances without providing direct end user or economic benefit? If so, then reword the OKR to focus on the tangible benefit. A classic example is launch X with no criteria for success. Better is to double fleet-wide Y by launching X to 90%+ of Borg cells. Trap number six is to have insufficient key results for committed OKRs. OKRs are divided into the desired outcome, the objective, and then the measurable steps required to achieve that outcome, the key results. It's critical that the key results are written such that scoring 1.0 on all KRs generates a 1.0 score for the objective. A common error in writing key results is that they're necessary but not sufficient to collectively complete the objective. That error is tempting because it allows a team to avoid the difficult resource priority and risk commitments needed to deliver hard key results. This trap is particularly pernicious because it delays both the discovery of the resource requirements for the objective and the discovery that the objective will not be completed on schedule. The litmus test is it reasonably possible to score 1.0 on all the key results, but still not achieve the intent of the objective? If so, add or rework the key results until their successful completion guarantees that the objective is also successfully completed. Let's talk about reading, interpreting, and acting on OKRs. For committed OKRs, teams are expected to rearrange their other priorities to ensure an on-schedule 1.0 delivery. And teams who cannot credibly promise to deliver 1.0 on a committed OKR must escalate promptly. This is a key point. Escalating in this common situation is not only okay, it is required. Whether the issue arose because of disagreement about the OKR, disagreement about its priority, or inability to allocate enough time, people, resources, escalation is good. It allows the team's management to develop options and resolve conflicts. The corollary is that every new OKR is likely to involve some amount of escalation, since it requires a change to existing priorities and commitments. An OKR that requires no changes to any group's activities is a business-as-usual OKR, and those are unlikely to be new, although they may not have previously been written down. A committed OKR that fails to achieve a 1.0 by its due date requires a postmortem. And this is not intended to punish teams. It's intended to understand what occurred in the planning and or execution of the OKR so that teams may improve their ability to reliably hit 1.0 on committed OKRs. Examples of classes of committed OKRs are ensuring that a service meets its service level agreement for the quarter, or delivering a defined feature or improvement to an infrastructure system by a set date, or manufacturing and delivering a quantity of servers at a cost point. Let's talk about aspirational OKRs. The set of aspirational OKRs will, by design, exceed the team's ability to execute in a given quarter. The OKR's priority should inform team member decisions on where to spend the remaining time they have after the group commitments are met. In general, higher priority OKRs should be completed before lower priority OKRs. Aspirational OKRs and their associated priorities should remain on a team's OKR list until they're completed, carrying them forward from quarter to quarter as necessary. Dropping them from the OKR list because of a lack of progress is a mistake, as it disguises persistent problems of prioritization, resource availability, or even a lack of understanding of the problem and solution. As a corollary, it's good to move an aspirational OKR to a different team's list if that team has both the expertise and bandwidth to accomplish the OKR more effectively than the current OKR owner. Team managers are expected to assess the resources required to accomplish their aspirational OKRs and ask for them each quarter, fulfilling their duty to express known demand to the business. Managers should not expect to receive all the required resources, however, unless their aspirational OKRs are the highest priority goals in the company after the committed OKRs. So here's some more litmus tests, simple tests to see if your OKRs are good. If you wrote them down in 5 minutes, they're probably not good. Think. If the objective doesn't fit on one line, it probably isn't crisp enough. If your KRs are expressed in team internal terms, like launch foo 4.1, they probably aren't good. What matters isn't the launch, but its impact. Why is 4.1 important? It would be better to say launch foo 4.1 to improve signups by 25%. Or simply, improve signups by 25%. Another litmus test, use real dates. If every key result happens on the last day of the quarter, you likely don't have a real plan. And make sure your key results are measurable. It must be possible to objectively assign a grade at the end of the quarter. Improved signups isn't a good key result. Better is improve daily signups by 25% by May 1. Make sure the metrics are unambiguous. If you say 1 million users, is that all-time users or 7-day actives? And if there are important activities on your team, or a significant fraction of its effort that aren't covered by OKRs, add more. For larger groups, make OKRs hierarchical. Have high-level ones for the entire team, more detailed ones for sub-teams. And make sure that the horizontal OKRs, the projects that need multiple teams to contribute, have supporting key results in each sub-team. Resource number two is a flowchart, a diagram of a typical OKR cycle. And you can find this graphic on the website whatmatters.com/OKR cycle. But I'll read it to you. Let's assume you're setting OKRs at the company, team, and contributor levels. Even larger organizations may have additional levels. 4 to 6 weeks before the end of a quarter and the beginning of a new one, you'll brainstorm annual and first quarter OKRs for the company. The senior leaders might start brainstorming the top line company OKRs. And if you're setting OKRs for the coming quarter, this is also the time in the first quarter to set them for the annual plan to help guide the direction of the company. 2 weeks before the start of that first quarter, You should communicate the company-wide OKRs for the coming year and first quarter. And then you can finalize the company OKRs, communicating them to the team. Based on the company's OKRs, the teams will then develop their own OKRs and share them at their meetings. 1 week after the start of the quarter, after the team OKRs are contributed, individual contributors can share their own OKRs. This may require negotiation between the contributors and their managers, typically in one-on-one settings. And then throughout the quarter, employees track progress and check in, measuring and sharing their progress, checking in with their managers. Periodically through the quarter, contributors will assess how likely they are to fully achieve their OKRs. And if attainment appears unlikely, they may need to recalibrate. Near the end of the quarter, contributors score their OKRs, perform a self-assessment, and reflect on what they've accomplished. And then this cycle rinses and repeats itself quarter after quarter. Resource number 3 is all about talk. It's a guide to performance conversations. Continuous performance management is a two-part interwoven process. The first part consists of setting OKRs. The second entails regular and ongoing conversations tailored to your needs. Let's talk about goal planning and reflection. To help facilitate this conversation, a manager might ask a contributor the following. What OKRs do you plan to focus on to drive the greatest value for your role, your team, and/or the company? And which of these OKRs aligns to key initiatives in the organization? Progress updates. To get the contributor talking, a manager might pose these questions. How are your OKRs coming along? What critical capabilities do you need to be successful? Is there anything stopping you from attaining your objectives? And what OKRs need to be adjusted or added or eliminated in light of shifting priorities? Let's talk about manager-led coaching. To prepare for this conversation, the manager should consider the following questions. What behaviors or values do I want my report to continue to exhibit? What behaviors or values do I want the report to start or stop exhibiting? What coaching can I provide to help the report fully realize his or her potential? During the conversation, the leader might ask, what part of your job excites you? What, if any, aspect of your role would you like to change? Let's talk about an upward feedback conversation. To elicit candid input from a contributor, the manager might ask, what are you getting from me that you find helpful? What are you getting from me that impedes your ability to be effective? What could I do for you that would help you be more successful? Here's some ideas for a career growth conversation. To tease out a contributor's career aspirations, a manager might ask, what skills or capabilities would you like to develop to improve in your current role? In what areas do you want to grow to achieve your career goals? What skills or capabilities would you like to develop for a future role? And from a learning, growth, and development standpoint, how can I and the company help you get there? Before launching a performance conversation with a contributor, some prep work is in order. Specifically, leaders should consider the following. What were the contributor's main objectives and responsibilities in the period in question? How has the contributor performed? If the contributor is underperforming, how should he or she course correct? If the contributor is performing well or exceeding expectations, what can I do to sustain a high level of performance without burnout? When is the contributor most engaged? When is the contributor least engaged? What strengths does the contributor bring to the work? What types of learning experience might benefit this contributor? And over the next 6 months, what should the contributor's focus be? Meeting expectations in his or her current role? Maximizing contributions in the current role? Or preparing for the next opportunity, be it a new project, expanded responsibility, or new role? Contributors, too, should prepare for performance conversations. Specifically, they can ask themselves, am I on track to meet my objectives? Have I identified areas of opportunity? Do I understand how my work connects to broader milestones? And what feedback can I give my manager? So resource number four is the book, in sum. Regarding focus and commit to priorities, set the appropriate cadence for your OKR cycle. I recommend dual tracking, with quarterly OKRs for shorter-term goals and annual OKRs keyed to the longer-term strategies. And deploy these, operate them in parallel. To work out implementation kinks and strengthen your leader's commitment, phase in your rollout of OKRs with upper management first. Allow the process to gain momentum before enlisting individual contributors to join in. Designate an OKR shepherd to make sure that every individual devotes the time each cycle to choosing what matters most. Commit to 3 to 5 top objectives, what you need to achieve per cycle. Too many OKRs dilute and scatter people's efforts. Expand your effective capacity by deciding what not to do, and discard, defer, or de-emphasize accordingly. In choosing OKRs, look for objectives with the most leverage for outstanding performance. Find the raw material for top-line OKRs in the organization's mission statement, strategic plan, or a broad theme chosen by leadership. To emphasize a departmental objective and enlist lateral support, elevate it to a company OKR. And for each objective, settle on no more than 5 measurable, unambiguous, time-bound key results. That's how the objective will be attained. By definition, the completion of all key results will equate to the attainment of the objective. For balance and quality control, pair qualitative and quantitative key results. And when a key result requires extra attention, elevate it into an objective for 1 or more cycles. The single most important element for OKR success is conviction and buy-in by the organization's leaders. So let's summarize thoughts about aligning and connecting for teamwork. We should incentivize employees by showing how their objectives relate to the leader's vision and the company's top priorities. The express route to operating excellence is lined with transparent public goals right on up to the CEO. Use all-hands meetings to explain why an OKR is important to the organization. Then keep repeating the message until you're tired of hearing it yourself. When deploying cascaded OKRs with objectives driven from the top, welcome give and take on key results from frontline contributors. Innovation dwells less at a company's center than at its edges. Encourage a healthy proportion of bottom-up OKRs, roughly half. Smash those departmental silos by connecting teams with horizontally shared OKRs. Cross-functional operations enable quick and coordinated decisions, the basis for seizing a competitive advantage. And make all lateral cross-functional dependencies explicit. When an OKR is revised or dropped, see to it that all stakeholders know about it. Let's talk about how we track for accountability. To build a culture of accountability, we should install continuous reassessment and honest and objective grading, starting at the top. When leaders openly admit their missteps, contributors feel freer to take healthy risks. Let's motivate contributors less with extrinsic rewards and more with open, tangible measures of their achievement. To keep OKRs timely and relevant, have the designated shepherd ride herd over regular check-ins and progress updates. Frequent check-ins enable teams and individuals to course-correct with agility or to fail fast. To sustain high performance, encourage weekly one-on-one OKR meetings between contributors and managers, plus monthly departmental meetings. And as conditions change, feel free to revise, add, or delete OKRs as appropriate, even in mid-cycle. Goals are not written in stone. It's counterproductive to hold stubbornly to objectives that are no longer relevant or attainable. At the cycle's end, use OKR grades plus subjective self-assessment to evaluate past performance, yes, celebrate achievements, and plan and improve for the future. Before pushing into the next cycle, take a moment to reflect upon and savor what you've accomplished in the last one. And to keep OKRs up to date and on point, invest in a dedicated automated cloud-based platform. Public, collaborative, real-time goal-setting systems work best. Let's summarize Stretch for Amazing. At the beginning of each cycle, distinguish between goals that must be attained 100%, those are committed OKRs, and those that are stretching for a big, hairy, audacious goal, a BHAG, or an aspirational OKR. And establish an environment where individuals are free to fail without judgment. To stimulate problem solving and spur people to greater achievement, set ambitious goals, even if it means some quarterly targets will be missed. But don't set the bar so high that an OKR is obviously unrealistic. Morale suffers when people know they can't succeed. To get leaps in productivity or innovation, let's follow Google's gospel of 10x and replace incremental OKRs with exponential ones. That's how industries get disrupted and categories reinvented. And design stretch OKRs to fit the organization's culture. A company's optimal stretch may vary over time, depending on the operating needs of the coming cycle. When a team fails to attain a stretch OKR, consider rolling the objective over to the next cycle, assuming the goal is still relevant. Let's summarize continuous performance management. To address issues before they become problems and give struggling contributors the support they need, let's move from annual performance management to continuous performance management. We can unleash ambitious goal setting by divorcing forward-looking OKRs from backward-looking annual reviews. Tying goal attainment to bonus checks invites sandbagging and risk-averse behavior. Let's replace competitive ratings and stack rankings with transparent strength-based multidimensional criteria for performance evaluations. Beyond the numbers, consider a contributor's team play, communication, and ambition in goal setting. Let's rely on intrinsic motivations, purposeful work, and opportunities for growth over financial incentives. They're far more powerful. And to power positive business results, let's implement ongoing CFRs, conversations, feedback, and recognition, in concert with goal setting. Transparent OKRs make coaching more concrete and useful. Continuous CFRs keep day-to-day work on point and genuinely collaborative. In performance-driving conversations between managers and contributors, let's allow the contributor to set the agenda. The manager's role is to learn and to coach. Let's make performance feedback two-way, ad hoc and multidimensional, unconstrained by the organization chart. Let's use anonymous pulse surveys for real-time feedback on particular operations or general morale, and strengthen connections between teams and departments with peer-to-peer feedback in conjunction with cross-functional OKRs. Let's employ peer recognition to enhance employee engagement and performance. For maximum impact, recognition should be frequent, specific, highly visible, and tied to top-line OKRs. Let's summarize the importance of culture. Culture aligns top-line OKRs with an organization's mission, vision, and North Star values. We should convey cultural values by word, but most of all by deed, and promote peak performance with collaboration and accountability. When OKRs are collective, let's assign key results to individuals and hold them accountable. To develop a high motivation culture, balance OKR catalysts, actions that support the work, with CFR nourishers, acts of interpersonal support, or even random acts of kindness. Let's use OKRs to promote transparency, clarity, purpose, and big picture orientation, and deploy CFRs to build positivity, enthusiasm, stretch thinking, and daily improvement. We should be alert to the need to address cultural barriers, especially issues of accountability and trust, before implementing OKRs. Resource number 5 is a list of books for further reading. On the subject of Andy Grove and Intel, there's his classic High Output Management by Andy Grove, and then a biography, The Life and Times of an American by Richard Tedlow, and another history of Intel, The Intel Trinity by Michael Malone, How Noyce, Moore, and Andy Grove Built the World's Most Important Company. On the topic of culture, I recommend How by Dov Seideman, Why How We Do Anything Means Everything. And then there's Sheryl Sandberg's instant classic, Lean In, Women, Work, and the Will to Lead. And Kim Scott's Radical Candor, Be a Kick-Ass Boss Without Losing Your Humanity. Jim Collins' books are classics, Good to Great, Why Some Companies Make the Leap and Others Don't, and Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, Why Some Thrive Despite Them All. There's some wonderful books on Google, How Google Works by Eric Schmidt and Jonathan Rosenberg, Work Rules, Insights from Inside Google That Will Transform How You Live and Lead by Laszlo Bock, and In the Plex, How Google Thinks, Works, and Shapes Our Lives by Stephen Levy. Some resources on OKRs are a short book, Radical Focus, Achieving Your Most Important Goals with OKRs by Christina Woodke, and of course, the website www.whatmatters.com. Acknowledgements. In closing this edition of Measure What Matters, I feel an overwhelming sense of gratitude. First, that I was so lucky to be heir to Andy Grove's system to amplify human potential, and then to watch inspiring entrepreneurs, leaders, and teams adapt it to reach for their dreams. I'm also thankful for our great country that rewards risk-taking, something I never take for granted. Most of all, I thank you, my readers, for your attention, engagement, and feedback. I hope you'll write to me at john@whatmatters.com. The coming to be of this book confirms my mantra that it takes a team to win. From inception to finished product, I thank the Portfolio Penguin team that made it all possible. My publisher, Adrian Zackheim, who foresaw its potential. My superlative editor, Stephanie Frerich, who went so many extra miles and somehow kept her good humor, and also Tara Kilbride, Olivia Peluso, and Will Weiser. I'm grateful to my agent, Mersini Stefanides, and my attorney, Peter Moldave. And especially grateful to the skilled and versatile Ryan Pashansaram, whose insights and judgment proved indispensable. A special thank you goes to the individuals who took time out of their impossibly busy schedules to read the manuscript and offer the feedback that made it so much better. To Bing Gordon, who also introduced me to Deborah Radabaugh, who introduced me to Coach Campbell. I thank Jonathan Rosenberg, who furnished so many perceptive observations on the Google way of using OKRs and pointed me to our stretch case studies. Thanks to Laszlo Bock, a brilliant thought leader on goals, continuous performance management, and culture, and to Dov Seideman, the great business philosopher, for his wisdom on culture and values. Thank you, Tom Friedman, Laureen Powell Jobs, Al Gore, Randy Komisar, and Sheryl Sandberg, friends with big brains and kind hearts, who shared their unique values and wisdom on building teams and institutions. Thanks to Jim Collins, my favorite business author, whose data-driven, crystalline thinking challenged and clarified my purpose. I couldn't have written this book had Jim not pointed the way forward in his own groundbreaking work. And I thank Walter Isaacson, biographer extraordinaire, whose good counsel and advice were instrumental as Measure What Matters began to take shape. I'd also like to thank my partners at Kleiner Perkins, whose commitment to entrepreneurs lifts me up every day. Mike Abbott, Brooke Byers, Eric Feng, Bing Gordon, Mamoun Hamid, Wen Shea, Noah Knopf, Randy Komisar, Mary Meeker, Mood Raghwani, Ted Schlein, and Beth Seidenberg. Also, thanks to Sue Biglieri, Alex Burns, Juliet DeBobany, Amanda Duckworth, Ruz Jazari, and Scott Riles. And special thanks to Raynell Rhodes, Cindy Chang, and Noel Miraglia for their unflagging support. And Tina Case, who found the photographs that brought this book to life. Our four OKR superpowers, supported and made meaningful by CFRs, are the scaffolding for Measure What Matters. But this book would be hollow without our insider stories to depict OKRs and CFRs in life and in real time. So here's a special thanks to the storytellers who shared so generously from their experience. I want to start with the Gates Foundation team, past and present, who are especially inspiring for the breathtaking scope and life-saving impact of their work. Thank you, Bill and Melinda, Patty Stonecipher, Larry Cohen, Bridget Arnold, Sylvia Matthews-Burrow, Susan Desmond-Hellman, Mark Sussman, and Ankur Vora. Your achievement will make its own epic book that we cannot wait to read. Thanks to our favorite Irish rock star who has built a global crusade to fight disease, poverty, and corruption. Thank you, Bono. Bless you. And your team of Jamie Drummond, David Lane, Lucy Matthews, Bobby Shriver, Gail Smith, and Ken Weber for your creation of one. Now, the Google game merits special attention. Yes, Larry Page, Sergey Brin, and Eric Schmidt have made Google the 21st century prototype for structured goal setting. Their resolve and results with OKRs impressed even Andy Grove. But I would be remiss to not recognize as well the 100,000-plus Google employees and alumni who have lived and spread the goals gospel globally. I particularly thank Sundar Pichai, Susan Wojcicki, Jonathan Rosenberg, and Christos Goodrow. Also, Tim Armstrong, Raja Iyagari, Shona Brown, Chris Dale, Beth Dowd, Salar Kamangar, Winnie King, Rick Clow, Shashir Mahotra, Eileen Naughton, Ruth Peratt, Brian Rakowski, Prasad Sethi, Esther Sun, Matt Suskin, Astro Teller, and Kent Walker. Intel's past and present leaders were magnanimous with their insights. Thank you to Gordon Moore, Les Fedez, Eva Grove, Bill Davidow, Dane Elliott, Jim Lally, and Casey Powell. Also to CEO Brian Krasinich, Steve Rogers, Kelly Kelly, and to Terry Murphy, Andy Grove's longtime executive assistant. From Remind, thanks to Brett Kopp, David Kopp, and Brian Gray. From Nuna, thank you to Jeannie Kim, David Chen, Katja Guzman, Nick Sung, and Sanjay Sivanasan. From MyFitnessPal, thanks to Mike Lee and David Lee. From Intuit, thanks to Atticus Tyson, Scott Cook, Brad Smith, Sherry Whiteley, and Olga Brailovsky. From Adobe, thanks Donna Morris, Shantanu Narayan, and Dan Rosenzweig. From Zoom, thanks to Julia Collins and Alex Garden. From Coursera, thank you Lila Ibrahim, Daphne Kohler, Andrew Ng, Rick Levin, and Jeff Mangion Kalda. From Lumeris, Andrew Cole, Art Glasgow, and Mike Long. From Schneider Electric, Hervé Carrel and Sharon Abraham. From Walmart, John Brothers, Becky Schmidt, and Angela Christman. From Khan Academy, Orly Friedman and Saul Khan. I am honored to acknowledge the experts who lent their insights, input, and many contributions to the OKR movement and this book. Alex Barnett, Tracy Beltran, Ethan Bernstein, Josh Burson, Ben Brooks, John Brothers, Aaron Butkus, Ivy Choi, John Chu, Roger Korn, Angus Davis, Chris Deptula, Patrick Foley, Uwe Higgin, Arnold Hurd, General Tom Kolditz, Corey Creek, Jonathan Lesser, Aaron Levy, Kevin Louie, Dennis Lyle, Chris Mason, Amelia Merrill, Deep Nishar, Bill Pence, Stephanie Pimel, Philip Potluff, Arielle Richard, Dr. David Rock, Timo Salcedar, Jake Schmidt, Aaron Sharp, Jeff Smith, Tim Staffa, Joseph Suzuki, Chris Villar, Jeff Wiener, Christina Wodke, and Jessica Woodall. Thanks especially to CEO Doug Dennerlein and the goal-oriented crew at BetterWorks, who are advancing OKRs and CFRs like no one else, while working better themselves every day. Not least, I'd like to thank some special individuals with whom I've been privileged to work over the years, and whose lives are exemplars of excellence. Notable among them, Jim Barksdale, Andy Bechtolsheim, Jeff Bezos, Scott Cook, Bill Joy, and K.R. Sridhar, and Andy Grove, Bill Campbell, and Steve Jobs, gone but never to be forgotten. I sincerely thank Jeff Coplin, who was at the center of the team that made this happen, and who proved once again that execution is everything. Long before I encountered OKRs, my father and hero, Lou Dorr, taught me the value of focus, commitment, high standards, and higher aspirations, and RMA, the right mental attitude. Finally, I offer my undying gratitude to my wife Anne and daughters Mary and Esther, whose patience, encouragement, and love kept me going through this long and challenging project. Each and every day, they remind me of what matters the most.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Measure What Matters, How Google, Bono, and the Gates Foundation Rock the World with OKRs by John Doerr. This program was directed by Mary Diltz, executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2018 by Bennett Group, LLC. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.